Welcome to the Let Good Things In show. I'm your host, Amanda Acker. I am so happy you are here. At the Let Good Things In show, we talk all about second chances, resiliency, following your intuition, and even music. Listen to hear stories of hope and to be inspired. Remember, you are stronger than you think. Let's dive in. Hi, my amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the show. Before we get into the episode, I'd just like to remind you that if you're loving the show, I would absolutely love to hear from you. Please send me an email, amanda@amandaacker.com. Acker is spelled A-C-K-E-R. Last week, I didn't release an episode because I decided to take a weekend and do some self-care and spend some quality time with my husband and my kids. They started school this week, so getting everything together. And I want to remind you, too, that it is so important to take breaks sometimes. I know that it feels like if you take a break, things will fall apart, but I promise you they won't. You need to take care of yourself. I talk about this all the time. But you really need to take some time to spend time with yourself, your family, your friends, whatever it is that brings you joy. It is so important that you take those breaks. So on this episode, I had the pleasure of bringing David Marion from the last episode back on, along with his ex-wife and business partner, Dana Golden. The conversation that we had was very insightful and deep, and we talked about some things that I've never talked about on the show. So I'm very excited to have had them both on the show and to be able to bring this candid conversation to all of you. So without further ado, let's dive in. Hi, David and Dana. Thank you so much for being here today for this interview. And I will just let everyone know who's listening. This is my first experience interviewing an ex-couple. So this should be an interesting conversation. So I would like to start things off with David. I know by the time this airs, I would have released your episode with your whole story and everything, our conversation, just me and you. But could you just give like a general recap of, you know, your story and, you know, your incarceration and things like that, then we can kind of go from there.
Yes. A recap of my story. Well, started using at a young age, was very successful, and my addictions took a hold of me, gambling, opioids, heroin. Eventually I was indicted for money laundering and mail fraud. And ended up getting sentenced to 60 months in federal prison. I served 36 of those months in and 6 months on the out. I had met Dana in 1992 when I moved to Minnesota from New York to get sober. And I had been sober 3 years. We met, got married quickly, had two daughters, and that is the quick elevator pitch to the third floor.
Well, thank you for that. So, Dana, I'd like to open it up to you now. You know, do you have any personal experience with addiction or any type of incarceration, or was your experience strictly through David's life?
Yeah. So my only affiliation with addiction was through every male in my life. So from my dad to boyfriends. And when I met David, he had been clean and sober for 3 years. So I thought I finally had it figured out. I was always attracted to that personality type, but this one, being David, had been through treatment and he was involved as far as getting on the other side of addiction, very involved in AA. And I was a speaker all over the country. So I really thought that I was in my recovery as the loved one of an addict and he was in recovery. So I thought, oh, this is good timing and this is what's going to work now. And what happened was relapse. And so, yeah, then that whole experience of his tumbling down and incarceration was the first of that for me.
So just to ask a question on that, Dana. So when he relapsed, how did that make you feel? Like, what was your reaction to that? And how did you kind of navigate that scenario?
Well, it's interesting because when you're prescribed prescription opiates, as the person being prescribed or the person married to the person being prescribed, you think it's okay because the doctor is telling you it's okay. And so because it came about in that way, I never questioned that it would be a problem. I did know that David was buying them on the black market. I knew that he was, his prescriptions had ran out and he was seeking more. But as he relapsed, I relapsed and I went right back into my denial and right back into my, I don't want to rock the boat. And, you know, we had a really comfortable lifestyle and we were raising two daughters. I didn't want to have to upend that. So you just turn a blind eye and I did my own thing with my girls. I let him do his thing. And then it just got snowballed. And to the point where I had to protect me and my girls and move away from that. And that was when my back into recovery began to take hold of knowing what I needed to do for me and my kids, because there's no stopping the addict. You know, I could only control what I could control for myself. So,
yeah, and that's a hard thing to navigate. You know, I have my own experiences with people throughout life, you know, in relationships who are addicts. So I can see it from both sides, you know, and I can only imagine, you know, how that felt to think that you have this man who is clean and sober and finally you find, you know, I like to say your knight in shining armor or whatever you want to call it, you know, and then it all just blows up. So, David, how are you feeling, you know, about how this was affecting Dana during, you know, when you first started into like your relapse?
You know, when you're riddled with addiction, it's a very self-absorbed disease. You know, it centers around your drugs and alcohol. And obviously we're not so empathetic of others because we have this physical addiction that's craving more and more. And so we kind of lose touch what other people are thinking and feeling. And my feelings towards others had, you know, it gets a lot of the blame game going on.
Yeah. So what about your daughters? Like how old were they when this was all happening? I'm just curious.
Well, when we divorced, it was 2005. Started the process. So the kids were pretty young. They were 7 and 9. And David's addictions had taken hold, but the indictment, it was another 6 years after we were divorced that the business got into trouble that David owned. And then the indictment came down. So we were already divorced for that. But, you know, our girls were like in junior high and high school, I think, when there was articles on the front page of the paper about David's indictment. And, you know, every week there in the business section was this big investigation going on and pictures of David and, you know, the terms fraud being thrown around in the paper. So that was really difficult. Not that the kids read the paper, but the parents read the paper and then they tell their kids, oh, did you see what, you know, Mr. Yeah. Marion did? And so then they're thrown in their face at school. But I will say that during that whole thing, they only missed one day of school, and that was for his trial. His sentencing, because they wanted to go to the sentencing. But you know, that's the part about when you talk about navigating through that, that's the part that is really the parents' responsibility, because, you know, the kids are going to react however the parents react. And my attitude the whole time was, hey, this is your dad's consequences because of choices he made. This is no reflection of you. You know, now your dad knows what happens when you make these choices. And so he'll make better choices in the future and you can hold your heads up high. You know, so it was just that ongoing conversation and navigating that, you know, dad has this disease of addiction. Your dad's a great person, but addiction takes a hold of that person. They become not the person that you know and love. And, you know, just exposing them to Alateen and Alitod at early ages so they could have their support and know that other people went through this too. They were involved with a counselor at their schools that for groups of kids that were going through divorce or mental illness or, you know, different things. So they always had support. And as a parent, that's how I navigated through it, was just not changing the conversation, not telling them non-truths. I think that's the most confusing thing for a kid when they're seeing and hearing two different things and you're telling them everything's fine and there's chaos going on that they're seeing. That sets them up for failure. And I think mental health issues in the future. So just being honest and always exposing them to the right resources, I think that's what navigating through those kinds of situations are about.
For sure. Yeah, it's so important that, you know, as kids, because I don't think, especially at, you know, these young ages, because my daughter's 8 and my son's 16, so those are two polar different age groups. But, you know, it's navigating and helping them see that it's okay to not be okay and that there is support and giving them that support, because that's something I didn't have. You know, my parents divorced. I had to figure it all out on my own at 15, and I didn't know how to navigate that, you know, so that's very admirable that you took that stance and made sure that they had support from you and outside support so they could, you know, still live a healthy life and not be, you know, basically, I don't want to use the word sabotage, but I can't think of any other word, but by the situations that they had no control over. It wasn't their fault, you know, so I that's awesome. So what was, both of you can kind of answer this in any order you want, but I want to get into like your relationship, you know, navigating, you know, the addiction and the divorce. Like how did you, were you guys always friends or was that something that happened over time?
That must have been one of your prepared questions.
It was not.
I would say that that happened over time. So obviously when one person is divorcing the other person, there's always resentment and bitterness and mm-hmm. anger. And because I was the one divorcing David, he went through all those emotions. And it was a battle. I mean, for 4 years, our divorce went on. We got a judgment within 2 years, but then we had to settle because the judgment was just kind of out of whack. And so it took us another 2 years to settle. So it was 4 years of animosity, to be honest.
Wow.
By the time we did settle, it was like just the flip of a light switch. As soon as we settled, it was over and we were friends again. Like just wow. A total change in attitudes. And so from that point on, then, which was great because once he was incarcerated, it made it very comfortable for me to take the kids to go see him and spend as much time on the weekends as they could afford and whatnot. So yeah, all through the incarceration, we were fine, very supportive, giving the girls what they needed to keep it that relationship going. And of course, and David can talk more to this, but as soon as, you know, he got clean and sober, was in prison, you know, his whole attitude and life changed and his relationships with his kids reversed and came spectacular. They are to this day. So he really flipped some switches. So.
David, do you have anything you'd like to add or say to that?
No, I think she covered it pretty well. You know, relationships always have their ebbs and flows, but when you're going through a divorce, it's a tough time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's knowing that you're not going to be with this person. You're knowing that your life is about to change. You don't know how it's going to change. You become accustomed to a certain way of life and the comfort of that life. And it's kind of like recovery. You know, you have to make the uncomfortable the comfortable in your life. Unfortunately, you don't know what it looks like. So, you know, we have this thing called blind faith. And can't see it, touch it, feel it, but you have to trust the process that other people have done this before you, and you will survive.
Yeah, very true. It is hard. Any type of recovery, whether it's addiction, I call it life recovery, right? Because we're all recovering from something in some way, and it is hard to change and see, you know, life beyond the tragedy that may be happening currently in your life. In your lives.
Amanda, I just want to say about that when we were, you know, we started working together in this, in the addiction space, once David was out of prison. And when we were coming up with the name for the company, we decided to call it the Life Recovery Coach because everybody's recovering from something. And it's not just, you know, recovery from, you know, alcohol and drugs. I mean, life, you got to recover from all kinds of things in life.
Yeah, life is not easy, right? So life has its ups and downs for sure. So what made you to decide to go into business together and do this addiction work that you do?
You want me to talk to that, David?
Sure.
So when David was going to prison, we knew that he had a story to tell. And I said, you're going to have some time on your hands. Why don't you write some stuff down? And then I'll turn it into words in a book. And we did. So we published a book called Addiction Rescue, The No BS Guide to Recovery. And from that moment on, from the time we got out of prison, we were like, we can help other people by talking about it, by showing people there is a path to repair relationships, though we're not married anymore. And that may not be the case for a lot of couples and families. You know, you can raise kids together. You can have amiable relationships. You can heal and repair. And so that's our mission, is to help families through that addiction process and to recover on both sides of addiction and the family members.
So on that note, like, what, you know, if there was a family or somebody who's listening who may be going through something similar where their partner's being incarcerated or they're going through divorce, like, what type of advice would either of you or both of you can answer? Like, would you give somebody going through something similar to what you both went through?
Well, it's funny, when people are getting incarcerated, they're in relationships, what you find is that most people leave the relationship, depending on the amount of time they're going to be doing in prison. And because they don't want to drag somebody else through that. So selfishly, they're trying to remove themselves in the situation so they can focus on the time they're being spent on prison. I think if you have a good relationship going in there, obviously, it takes a turn, you know, depending on your sentence. You know, someone's getting, you know, 5 to 10 year sentence. Many people don't stay together through that process, as we found. But I think it's all based on the relationship. You know, everyone knows what they have in the relationship. Is it worth fighting for? You know, is it worth resuming it once they get out? Is it worth a continuation? So I think it's kind of an individual thing, knowing where you're at in the relationship to see if this thing is, if there's really strength behind it and there's a passion to keep moving forward together, that you don't want to leave that person.
And what about you, Dana?
Yeah, you know, I think it comes down to self-care and how can you take care of yourself best and staying in your lane and figuring out what you need and how you can move forward in treating yourself the best that you can. And that's what I advocate for families that I work with, is to take you back, because so oftentimes, especially, you know, when there's addiction involved, is that the family members give up their hopes and dreams, and all their hopes and dreams become about their loved one getting into treatment, getting into recovery. You know, if there's trouble with the law, lawyers, you know, just helping them through all of that, that becomes their focus, and they forget what their hopes and dreams are for themselves because they become 100% consumed with the other person. So, you know, it's my job as a family coach to come in there and say, what about you? You know, how can you take care mm-hmm. of you? How can you separate yourself from this person? How can you stay in your lane? How can you separate the responsibilities of what you're responsible for and what you're taking on that aren't rightfully yours? So those are the things I focus on.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of times, you know, in any type of relationship that has some sort of, you know, whether it's, you know, abuse or addiction, incarceration, like we forget about ourselves, you know, so it's so important to remember that, you know, you can be selfish. I saw something on Instagram the other day that like struck me about being selfish, and it's okay, because how can you be good for anybody if you're not happy within yourself, you know, and that's so important that we don't forget about ourselves. So thank you for bringing that up, because that's very important.
Yeah. And I always, along those lines, Amanda, I always say loving, you know, you doesn't mean loving your loved one any less. It just means loving yourself more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what else can I ask about your relationship? When it comes to resentment, this is what I had prepared. I wanted to talk about the resentment. Like, I know you both said that there was resentment in the beginning, you know, of the divorce and all of that. So how, I know you said it all kind of like, kind of just flipped a switch whenever you settled, but how did you deal with that resentment? Like, did you guys argue a lot, or were you fully separated? Were you still living together? Like, what did that look like?
No, we were definitely separated. We had our own living spaces and we stayed away from each other. You know, the only times we really had to see each other was dropping the kids to and from. And we just stayed away. David was just really angry. He was really angry. David's, you know, a big guy. He's like 6'6". He's like 200.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize you were that tall. Yeah, I feel like a midget.
Well, because he's not just tall and skinny, right? He's like a big guy, right? He probably weighs, I don't know, what, 235, 240? I have no idea how much he weighs.
270.
Okay. So he's 6'6" and weighs 270 pounds, right?
I'm 6'5".
Oh, 6'5". You shrunk. No.
No, I've never been 6'6", but.
Oh, okay. I always thought. Anyway, 6'6" sounded good. So he's this really big guy and he's, you know, he came from Wall Street. He was a sales manager on Wall Street. He, you know, managed, you know, 60, 70 brokers at a time. He's, you know, very motivational. He's a motivational speaker. He's a sales trainer and he commands a room and David Marion gets what David Marion wants. I mean, he's just that type of guy. People just love him. He's got charisma. He's this big, you know, various character. And I was probably one of the first people that just said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. And people didn't do that to him. So I think that that was like a big, I don't know, would you say was a blow to your ego? Was it just like you were just mad? You were really angry at me at the time. We haven't talked about this, Amanda. So this is a kind of a first.
Yeah, of course you're angry. You're angry that you've been rejected. You're angry that your ego and pride has been shattered. You're angry that your world is being turned upside down. You know, you're angry that the script is not playing out to how it was written, and all these different things. And yes, there was a lot of resentments, but I think the resentments quickly turned to anger. And, you know, it just focused on different things like drugs and more women and doing other things and, you know, fulfilling that hole. And you can't fulfill it. You know,
Yeah. You
got to eventually pull the shit from the roots. Otherwise, you're never going to get through it. You know, you can dance around the issue all you want, but inevitably, no matter where you go, there you are. Right? You're going to stop.
Yeah, exactly.
So my thing was, this is what I used to say to myself. So, because he was so angry at me and so mad, and we really couldn't have a conversation because he was just really bitter and stuff. And I just kept saying to myself, if I was divorcing me, I'd be really angry too. So that's how I got through. And I didn't want to be mad. I didn't want to be angry. Like I knew I was hurting him. I felt, especially being the caretaker, enabler, codependent person. I mean, it killed me that I was hurting him. I mean, that was the hardest thing for me, was to know that all I had to do was say, okay, I'll stop this process and we won't proceed and we'll get back together. And I knew I could stop his anger and hurt. And it was everything I could do to stay on that path of, I have to do this for me and I can't acquiesce to not hurting him, because it's harder for me to hurt someone else than it is to hurt myself, right? I'd rather go through the hurt myself than to know I'm hurting someone. So that was really hard for me, you know, none of it's easy.
No, it's not easy at all. Now, did you, well, I know, David, you were in active addiction during all this, but Dana, like, did you seek out any therapy for yourself too while navigating all this?
Oh yeah. I went to Al-Anon forever. I had a therapist that I saw at least once a week. There were times I was here twice a week. Yeah. Because I needed that support for sure. You know, am I doing the right thing? And was that David?
Part of her therapy was going to Vegas all the time during this application. So,
well, there's a backstory to that. But we don't have to get into that.
Vegas sounds like a good escape from reality. I've never been. But anyways, so I'm through all of that. So you're going to therapy. David, you're still in active addiction. So then, like, I can't remember if you said this already, but what was the time frame from the divorce to the indictment? Did you say it was 6 years later?
About four.
So did you ever try to get clean during that time? Or was jail...
Clean about a year and a half before I went in, knowing that I didn't want to have to deal with it. So when I went in.
And then since your relationship was mended prior to you being incarcerated, would you say that Dana was a good support for you through that process?
Sure. Yeah.
And then when you were in there, I know she said that you brought your daughters to visit you and all that. Like, what was that experience like seeing them while you were incarcerated?
Well, it was the worst in the world. You know, it was great to see them, but at the end of the day, when they left and I had to go behind the fence and I'm watching them drive off, you know, believe me, you thought about several ways of killing yourself. The pain was probably the worst pain I've witnessed in a long time. That loneliness, being withdrawn, being separated from your family and nothing you could do about it. You know, not to mention losing your freedom, losing it. That you've had, and you know, you're trying to start a life over again, and it's almost like you're so broken that you don't even know where to begin. You don't even know if you have a chance.
Wow, that just brought tears to my eyes, just you saying that, because I can relate to that feeling. I had my son when I was incarcerated, and when he would leave, it
was,
you can't even put that pain into words, you know. You just can't. And Dana, like, what did it feel like for you, like, going and visiting him with the girls and then having to leave him behind? How was that emotionally for you?
You know, I guess when I look back on it, I really cherished the time because I was running a business and trying to keep everything financially going because we had nothing left. And David was still, like, my mentor, my sounding board. For the business that I was running. And although it was my business, he helped me set it up before he went into prison because we knew I was going to need to be set up. So, you know, I looked forward to those because that was my time. You know, we could email back and forth a little bit and we could talk a little bit on the phone, but those are my times to really use him as a sounding board and talk to him about what was going on at my office. And so I guess, you know, it was always just so fulfilling for me to have that time with him and to see him with the girls. So I always looked at it, you know, for me, it's like I went back to my life, right? The kids and I were busy, there were activities. I had this office and guys I was running. And so it wasn't like that. I didn't feel what David felt when we left. You know, I was like, oh, good. I got what I needed out of this visit. I can carry on for the next week, you know, until I see him again or whatever it was. So, you know, he was supporting me as much as I was supporting him, although it probably didn't feel that way to him.
Yeah. Well, you know, like the visiting, like that's such a, you know, weird dynamic because I've never talked to anyone about that before from the other side, you know, and, you know, I was the one on the inside being visited, so I can relate to what David said, but you know, with your response, like I can see it, you know, I could see like if I had someone that I was cared for or had kids with who was incarcerated, like leaving, like, okay, like now we go back to our lives and everything's fine. And then we're going to go back and see him again. You know, like that, I can try my best to understand that emotion towards it.
Yeah, and you have to understand too, that David and I have been divorced a while and I was the one that had, you know, divorced him. So I didn't have that emotional attachment to him like the kids had, you know, and I think it was harder on them for sure than it was on me.
That makes sense. So moving away from all the tragedy and now David's out of prison, you know, did he, I believe you told me, David, previously that you went and stayed with Dana when you got out. Is that correct?
Yes.
So how was that like for you having him back in the house after he was released?
Well, my kids told me that, well, he, you know, his options were to live at home, which was the kids' address, or in a halfway house. And my kids said, Mom, if you make Dad live in a halfway house, we'll never talk to you again. I'm like, okay, you can live in the, I don't care. Fine. So, so it was just the obvious thing. I wouldn't have wanted that for him either, but it was just kind of funny that the kids, you know, were that adamant about it. So he moved in. I'm glad that he was there because were both the kids gone to college? Yeah, they were both in college. Actually, they both came home the weekend he came home to visit him from college right away. But, you know, I'm glad he had that support because I saw how hard that was on him to come out of prison. And I was so surprised and shocked that his time first coming home to me was so much worse seeing him in that position than it was when I would see him in prison. I mean, just to see him so lost and so, like he just said, how do you start over? And you have to understand, we had no money. I mean, he had gambled everything away. I mean, I was renting a home because we had two homes. We lost both our homes. I was, you know, hustling, working two jobs to keep the kids going and in college and all that. So, you know, here he comes out of that with nothing, literally has to start completely over in life. It was hard to watch him go through that. And I was glad that he was at the house because he had the support of if the kids came home to visit, they were there with him and I was there and he had a built-in support system. So that was like the hardest part on me for sure, was seeing him in that state.
Wow. And then like, how long did it take for you both to, you know, start the business that you're doing now and, you know, get your, both of your feet back on the ground to be able to move forward in life?
That's really, once I came out of prison, I was looking for something and get certified as an interventionist within the first year.
Wow.
You know, I was looking to do a bunch of different things, not knowing what to do. How do you recreate yourself at, you know, 50 some odd years old, right? And how do you figure out what to do? Which is why we say the cut is extremely deep when you go through this. You know, the recidivism is so high because many succumb to all of the rejections in life and the no's and feeling like every door is closing on them and they're not going to make it through this. And so, yeah, I kind of got involved in that right away. I knew I loved doing it. I did interventions earlier on in life. Always worked with people in that sense and helped people. And now I was going to make it a business. And of course, starting up a business, knowing that you have this past behind you, that everyone is going to judge you, everyone is going to shun you for what happened, and no one wants to give you a chance. And conference working events, and I had to just, you know, shake hands and kiss babies for a long time. You know, it got to the point where it was just like nothing was going on, nothing was clicking. But I knew I wasn't going to give up. You know, I have some inner drive that tells me that, you know, I could always sell myself no matter what, right? And I had to turn a buck and I had to make money when chips are down and things are tough. And I just kept fighting and fighting and doing what I had to do.
So what is that? So to move forward to, you know, current time, you know, what does your lives look like together now? Like, how are you able to, I mean, I can tell that you guys have so much history just by being on Zoom with both of you. I can like feel that you guys really, really know each other. So like, how is that now? Like seeing each other, you know, I don't know if you're both in different relationships or what, like how do you, you know, handle and navigate that work relationship since you work together and also the personal side of things? What does that look like now that you're, you know, David's healthy and sober?
I just think we're really great friends. We really respect each other and we respect each other's work ethic and what each of us brings to the table. We are both in relationships. David now lives in Florida. I'm still in Minnesota. And, you know, we talk pretty much on a daily basis. You know, we run an intervention and coaching business together. And I'm kind of the back end of all that, right? So I'm making travel arrangements for him and booking all of that kind of stuff, working with his families where he's doing interventions. He's coaching, I'm helping the families. So, you know, we're very involved in the business and we both have really understanding partners. You know, there's no threat of anything there. We've, like you said, we just have a lot of history and we make it work.
That's amazing. Cause I couldn't imagine working with any of my exes. So just like, I don't know how you do it, but kudos to you. That's amazing. And I've just never, like when I first met both of you, I didn't know that you guys were divorced. And when you told me, I was like, wait, what? You know, we must talk about this, you know, and then what advice would you give to maybe another, you know, couple who's out there that might be in a similar situation to kind of have a positive relationship with each other without holding all that resentment? Because I'm sure that, you know, the resentment, you know, is a hard thing to get over. I know from experience. not easy. So do you have any advice for a situation like that?
Well, my first advice, especially if you're dealing with addiction, is that you have to separate the person from the addiction that they have, because they turn into people that they don't even want to be, let alone how they're treating you. And I knew I married a really good person in David, but unfortunately he relapsed and that disease was really bad for him. So I always knew I liked David marrying the sober guy, but his addiction, you know, it's like loving your kids, right? You love them even when they're naughty, but when they're being naughty, you don't like their behavior. So you got to separate the behavior from the person. So that's my biggest advice to someone. And there was something there originally that made you fall in love, want to be with this person. You know, you got to focus on that and not on the naughtiness of the behavior that they're going through.
You know, I like that you said that, because now when I said earlier how I couldn't work with any of my exes, but if I seriously thought here and sat here and thought about it, like, you're right. Like, it's not like, you know, their faults and the reasons why we broke up wasn't the reasons why we got together. You know, you don't get, normally people don't get together with someone thinking, oh, this guy's an asshole, so I'm going to go be with them for like 10 years of my life. You know, you don't do that. There was a reason. You're right. There was that connection. And if we can focus on that, and especially when there's kids involved, you know, and focus on and just have whatever relationship. I'm not saying everyone needs to work together. I mean, it's beautiful what you two have, but you know, that's not going to work for everyone. But when there's kids involved and things like that, we have to be able to find common ground and be able to work together in some capacity to keep things positive for our children. You know, we can't always be at each other's throats and causing issues for them through our own issues together. If that made sense.
Yeah, and it all goes back to two is nobody can make you feel any certain way. You know, it's all about your attitude and your reaction to it. And there's a way to diffuse that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's all about, you know, keeping in your lane and your head on straight and not reacting and overreacting as a lot of us do.
But I think resentments and anger also void you of the spirit of happiness. You know, they're really blocking that spirit from coming in, because you have such a built up resistance towards them. And, you know, that anger is toxic. Resentments are really just so unhealthy in your life that you focus on the negativity and you can't manifest any positivity when this is happening, because it is becoming almost a complete obsession of mind, body, and spirit. So, you know, in order to find happiness, you have to rid yourselves of these things.
Yeah, that's true. Anger is a horrible thing to hold on to, you know, and eventually it wears at you and makes you an angry person, you know, and that's not, nobody wants to be that. That's not, I'm sure people out there who may still be holding on to anger, you know, you don't want that. You just have to figure out a way, like you said, Dana, too, like, to figure out a way to, you know, manage that and keep your head on and keep heading in the direction for yourself. You know, like we talked about earlier, like being selfish and taking care of you and letting go of that anger, seeking out therapy if that's what works for you, or, you know, seeking a support person and doing all those things so that you can be the best version of yourself, so that you can flourish in life, you know, and let go of that anger, that mentor, that person. Because if you're no longer with them, time to let go, you know, and it can be really hard. So my other question is, you know, if someone was looking for help for their loved one, you know, maybe they feel that their loved one needs an intervention or they're looking for support, how could they connect with either of you to get that support?
Well, the website is thelife recovery coach.com. There's a calendar in there. We will, you know, it's free. We do free consultations. We'll talk to you for as long as it takes to figure out what's needed, what path. If we don't have the path for you, we'll give you the resources to get on a path. On our website too is a link to buy our book. We have a free downloadable workbook to work alongside the book.
What's the name of the book?
Addiction Rescue, the No BS Guide to Recovery. This is the book. And it's really a all-inclusive book on determining if there's an addiction problem, and then how to get into and stay into recovery. We have a 5-step process in there. And it really talks about how to heal body, mind, and spirit, all three areas that addiction wrecks you know, the wreckage it causes to body, mind, and spirit. So it's a really comprehensive, easy to read, has a lot of David's story, but a lot of also just helpful hints and lists of ways to practice self-care, of how to prevent relapse, how to get rid of obsessive thinking. It just really comprehensive to everything addiction and recovery. Yeah, so that's how you can get a hold of us.
Awesome. Well, thank you for that. And I know I asked you my golden question, David, in our last session, but Dana, I would love to hear from you too. What would your number one tip be for our listeners to allow the good things into their lives?
I think I said most of my biggest tips. Self-care, you know, putting yourself first is not selfish. Loving people through the good and bad. I guess those would be my biggest tips. And really, if there's addiction involved, you got to learn to separate the person that you love from the addiction that they're causing them to behave naughty.
My number one.
Love that.
Ready? Mm-hmm. Ask for help. You don't have to do this alone. But many people think that they have too much shame, the stigma around saying that I have this problem, I have this issue. They're unwilling to ask for help.
Yeah.
Yep. Asking for help is not a sign of weakness. I think that's, you know, aligned with that, because a lot of people that I've talked to and throughout life, you know, if I ask for help, I'm going to look weak. It's like, no, if you ask for help, that's strength, right? You know, because you're saying I have a problem and I can't do this on my own and I need help. That's very important. So thank you, David, for saying that.
Go ahead. I was going to say, I should throw out our email. It's info@liferecoverycoach.com if you want to email and ask any questions or need anything.
Are either of you on social media? Where are you? Have like Instagram or anywhere people can follow you?
Yes, on Instagram, the Life Recovery Coach. Facebook, David Marion. Dana has hers, Dana Golden.
And then we're both on LinkedIn under our names, Dana Golden and David Marion. We both have a presence on LinkedIn to connect.
Awesome. Well, do either of you have any final words you'd like to say about our conversation today?
I think it's always a helpful conversation. You know, I think the important thing is that there's so many people out there looking for a solution in life. They're living in the problem. And they're trying to figure out the solution to their own problems. And sometimes it really makes it difficult. So when you talk to people and have that mere conversation and learn how to become transparent in your life, it becomes a lot easier.
Yeah. And my tip for anybody on the other side of this, if your loved one is an addict or facing prison time or trouble with financial law, whatever, that it's just as important for us loved ones of that person to get into our own recovery and figure out what's your responsibility and leave your loved one to theirs. Because by softening the blows and sugarcoating the issues and keeping them from the natural consequences of their actions is only prolonging the inevitable and keeping everybody stuck. So,
very true. Well, thank you so much, David, for coming back, and for Dana, for you coming here and having this open conversation with me and my audience. I truly appreciate it and your time. Thank you.
Always good to see you. Yeah.
Yeah. It was great to see you, Amanda. Thank you for having both of us.
Yeah. And as a reminder to everyone listening, remember, you are stronger than you think, and you can have the life you imagine, regardless of your past. Make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of the show, and I will talk to you all soon.